This is episode 371, dated Friday, August 2nd, 2024.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. This is episode 371, dated Friday, August 2nd, 2024. August already. Unbelievable. Time flies when you're having fun. Before we continue, let me introduce our good friend, our colleague, and the co-host for this show, Peter O'Toole, all the way from Coos Bay, Oregon. Peter, has it warmed up there yet?
No. And we're very happy it hasn't warmed up. It's gotten a little more humid, but it's, I don't know, 65 degrees and cloudy last I checked. And we're happy that it's this way. We're happy for the cool summers and relatively warm winters.
We've been at 92 plus the past 2 days here in New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's very humid and typical dog day weather here in New Bedford.
We feel your pain.
Before we continue, allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be available. We start out with our producer, Raymond Gay. Thank you for what you do. The media outlets, thank you for airing us when you do. We appreciate that very much. Also, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions, thank you very much for archiving our shows on my website. All you have to do to find these shows is go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down till you get to In Perspective Podcasts. Click on them and you will see most of our archived programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
I also want to thank Trish for being our facilitator today, along with Herbie. And of course, Brad is mainstreaming our show on ACB Media 5. And because he's doing that, let me give out my email address for people who have comments or questions about our podcast. bobbranco93@gmail.com. That's bobbranco93@gmail.com. We have with us once again Jesse Shirek. He is with the National Federation of the Blind. He's a social security expert. He's here to talk about something else, but we're going to start out by talking about a resolution that was passed at the NFB convention having to do with subjects that are near and dear to my heart, especially the third of the three, which is the marriage penalty, the other two being Social Security and SSI. I am married. I've been married for nearly 5 years. It's going to be 5 years in 3 weeks that Amy and I have been married, although I've been battling this marriage penalty issue for years and years prior to my wedding because I feel that they're setting the bar way too low income-wise for both partners to be able to manage the household income. And I'm very glad about this resolution. I'm hearing it's well-received. So, Jesse, if you can update us on what happened and what it means after I welcome you to the program once again. How are you, Jesse?
Hey, Bob. I am doing great. It's wonderful to be here with you today. I really appreciate the invitation and looking forward to talking to you about Social Security and autonomous vehicles.
So tell us what happened at the convention and why was it important to pass this resolution? What is the
Sure. So in the National Federation of the Blind, any of our members can bring a resolution to the Resolutions Committee, and at that Resolutions Committee, it can be defended, and then, you know, it passed unanimously. There was no question about the importance of this resolution, and I'll talk a little bit more about it in a minute. But then, you know, it went on to the General Session floor and passed unanimously. You know, everybody seems to think that this is a really good idea. So now this is policy of the National Federation of the Blind. We've already supported, you know, similar legislation that's out there, but this is now policy. So it's something that, you know, our members can use as a tool to help advocate both with lawmakers and with the Social Security Administration. So what we're calling for is, first of all, raising the resource limit for SSI. So if a single individual receives SSI, they're limited to $2,000 in resources. Doesn't count their home, doesn't count their car. but it can count any money that you have in the bank unless it's in an ABLE account. So essentially, there's no way for a person to save up. And for a married couple, you can only have $3,000 in resources, which is where the marriage penalty piece comes in. It's one area where the marriage penalty piece comes in. The other piece is that SSI beneficiaries, if a single person can receive $943 as a single individual and $1,415 for a married couple. So for the resource limit, you can see that, you know, there's a $1,000 penalty there that a person would be able to receive. Now, we want to eliminate the marriage penalty, both for the resource limit, but also for the amount of money that a person can receive in their SSI benefits. But we don't think that takes it far enough. When SSI was first created, the resource limit was 1/10, was 10% of the benefit check. You know, right now, as I said, the average benefit check, or the benefit check, is $943. So, you know, it's almost half of a benefit check the resource limit is double what you can receive in a benefits check. So we think that needs to change, and we think that it should go back to the same ratio it was when the program was created, 10 times the benefit check. So we're suggesting a resource limit of $10,000 for single individuals and $20,000 for married couples to make it a fair and eliminate the marriage penalty. And we also, you know, as inflation increases, we want to make sure that this number is tied to inflation. So this $10,000 amount, this $20,000 resource limit should be tied to inflation, just like benefit checks are tied to inflation. So as a tool, this is something that our members can use when, you know, reaching out to members of Congress to say, hey, I receive SSI and, you know, this really impacts my ability to maintain my benefits. And, you know, this marriage penalty is not just, and you can encourage your mayor member of Congress to support raising the resource limit and eliminating the marriage penalty.
So I have sort of two questions, Jesse. The first one is, apart from what you just said, that it influences your members and gives them a talking point, which is really important. Mm-hmm. It's important from a perspective of NFB's, you know, policy. What does this mean for, given the lay of the land politically, what are the chances of something like this actually, you know, getting through Congress over the next few years, or in the next few weeks for that matter? You know, talk about the lay of the land about what's going on.
Well, I think it's hard to say. I think in terms of getting through Congress, I think the challenge is we have, you know, we're a nonpartisan organization. So Congress is split right now. So you have the House of Representatives that leans towards Republicans, and then you have the Senate, which leans Democratic, towards Democrats. And I think the issue is going to be the potential cost involved in this. I think if this could get scored, essentially calculating how much this would cost the average taxpayer, and if that tax score has a low amount, then the odds of it passing are a lot better than if it has a high score. You know, that's how the government tends to look at these types of issues. And if the score is really high, if it's, you know, $10 million, $20 million, $30 million, in this Congress, it probably doesn't have very good odds of passing. Of course, we have a Democrat as president. So, I mean, I'm sure if it did pass through both chambers, it would get signed into law. But I think the big challenge is getting it to the president's desk in this particular Congress. So if things were to switch after November, and if we were to have both House and Senate that leaned Democrat and a president that leaned Democrat, I think it would have a much better chance of passing. The Democrats are very much interested in passing Social Security reform. They have a package called SSA 2100 that contains, you know, the marriage penalty, elimination of the marriage penalty, raising the resource limit. So, I mean, this is right in line with the Democrat agenda. So I guess right now, our community needs to speak by voting. We need to vote on the issues that are important to us.
So I have one more question for you, Jesse, which is sort of related. You talked about SSA 2100, and I suspect there are other bills floating around to reform Social Security. Is there one bill that has a better shot of passing than other bills? You know, we talked a little last time about this, but you know, what is your sense of what, you know, what bill out there that might have a better chance at passing than other bills?
Well, SSA 2100 is a package. So essentially it's a whole bunch of bills combined into one big bill. Sherrod Brown did have a bill that does what we're speaking of. And it's a bill that we've supported previously. I would have to go back and take a look at how many co-sponsors that bill has to see if it has any teeth, if it's likely to move. But I really think right now when Congress comes back, they're going to be very much focused on the appropriations bills, paying, you know, restarting the government. They're going to be back in September and then they're off in October. And then we have the election. So I have a feeling that, you know, really, we're probably going to have to wait till the next Congress to really make any major strides with issues involving Social Security. Things really take a long time to pick up momentum. It really is a slow moving process. Unless, you know, our community comes out in full strength and says, this is a really important issue that, you know, we want supported.
That's all for me, because I know we want to talk about other things. Bob, is that all for you?
I'm very satisfied with what you said, Jesse, and here's hoping that Congress or whoever else is involved with this process doesn't take their time and does the right thing by this resolution to help all the people who need it passed officially. And we appreciate the efforts that the National Federation of the Blind have done to get to this point, Jesse. So let me commend the organization publicly for recognizing the problems that some of us here in the blind community and a lot of other people as well, mm-hmm. what we have to face.
Hey, well, let me second that, by the way, Jesse. I appreciate that as well.
Well, we appreciate that. I'll pass that on to my colleagues and when I speak with people in the community as well. Really appreciate that.
Perfect.
Oh, very good. So Jesse, you're going to really have to convince me today, if you can, that it's perfectly okay to ride in an autonomous car.
Sure.
As of right now, I will never, ever ride mm-hmm. in a driverless car.
Well,
so
I'll tell you this.
You're going to have to convince me otherwise.
Well, what if I change the goalpost on you?
Oh, please
so
do.
What if I try to convince you that it's really important for us to be very active in this space? And let me give you an example. You know, think about when, say, Microsoft Windows was designed way back when, you know, Windows 3.1 was, you know, came out. That was the first version of Windows that I used. When Windows was designed, it wasn't designed with the blind community in mind, right? It was a visual interface. You had to be able to use a mouse but we were able to get it modified with talking software. And as you know, a lot of us are, you know, use JAWS, we use NVDA, we use Narrator. And now Microsoft is working with the blind community and other disability communities, right? So
yeah.
Autonomous vehicles. Well, here's where I'm going with that. Autonomous vehicles are here. They're here now. And we've been at the table with the auto industry the entire way, ensuring that as this technology develops, that it works for us. Not only does it work for us, we have to ensure that we're able to use it independently. We need to make sure that a blind person is able to take an autonomous vehicle independently from one destination to another. And right now there's nothing barring us from doing that. you can fly to San Francisco and you can take a Waymo One 24 hours a day. And that car will pull up. There will be no driver in that car, and it will take you from where the pickup to your destination. Now, there's a lot that needs to be said about that.
It's a fallible piece of machinery, however.
Yeah, it's a piece of machinery that is literally developing as we speak. So, and I also would say that human drivers are fallible as well. You know, we get very, I don't drive, I'm blind, but human drivers get very distracted by their cell phones, by text messages, by phone calls, by, you know, children in the backseat. You know, this is a technology that doesn't get distracted. And the bottom line is, eventually these cars will be on the road across the country. So we have a choice, and our choice is, do we want to be a part of that conversation? Do we want to make sure that these cars are working the way they are working correctly for the blind community? Or do we want engineers designing these cars and leaving us out of the conversation?
Jesse, I think it might be helpful if you could give us a brief history of the autonomous vehicle, you know, sort of how did it start? Where are we now? You know, give us the cliff notes.
Yeah. So essentially with autonomous vehicles, there are essentially categories of autonomous vehicles. They come in various levels, level 1 through level 5. Okay. So there have been autonomous vehicles that have had a person behind the wheel. You know, even think about like vehicles that have some partially autonomous features to them, some that have some self-driving features to them, like a Tesla. You know, that is not an autonomous vehicle, and people seem to think that it is. So it started out with vehicles like that. But what we've progressed to is a technology that uses artificial intelligence. It uses 3 different types of sensors. So it, you know, people, we use vision when we drive. So you can see 180 degrees. When the car drives, it sees 360 degrees. It sees in all directions. But, you know, as we know, if there's fog, there's limitations in terms of what the car can see.
Ice.
So they also use various sensors. They use infrared laser. It's called LIDAR. And so that can be used to measure distance. It can be used to view objects. And then it also uses sound waves. So it puts off sound waves in all directions. So if you think about those senses that you use, you get feedback from your environment, right? If you're in a room and you clap your hands and the room doesn't have very much furniture in it, there's a lot of echo. And your ears can sense that room is almost empty. In the same way that your ears can sense that the room is almost empty, you know, these autonomous vehicles are able to send out sound waves that can tell the car that there's nothing acting as an object that's going to block the car from traveling. You know, these cars are able, even if their line of sight is obscured, like say there's a semi-truck, you're on the interstate and there's a semi-truck in front of you, a large semi-truck that a driver wouldn't be able to see around. That autonomous vehicle can see around that semi-truck to see if there's, you know, a drunk driver coming down the wrong way. So it can see much further than a person's able to see. And when I use the word see, I don't mean necessarily visually. I mean, it's able to perceive its environment much further out than a person is able to detect.
Jesse, tell
us. Right now. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. You want to finish, Gora? I'll let you finish.
Okay. Okay.
Then I have a question.
Okay. So currently, so the next stage of this, you know, now that we've kind of talked about like how that piece works, the way that it developed is Waymo and Cruise were 2 companies that produce autonomous vehicles. They do it in a different way. Waymo uses Jaguars. It's actually a vehicle that's retrofitted. They put technology onto the car to make it an autonomous vehicle. Whereas Cruise, which is a company owned by Chevrolet, creates purpose-built autonomous vehicles. And what that means is it's not designed with a human driver in mind. It's not designed to have a steering wheel. It's not designed to have brake pedals. It essentially is, you can think of it like two bench seats facing each other. So you can have a conversation with other passengers in the car. It's literally, you know, a completely different concept.
My question is, how does it know where you want to go?
Sure. So the way it currently works is you can download an app onto your smartphone. And what you can do with this app is you just like calling a rideshare, calling an Uber, calling a Lyft, it comes to you. So it'll come to a set destination. And so the next question the question it begs is, how as a blind person do I find the car, right? Yeah. So there's a button, at least with Waymo, there's a button on the app that you press. And what it will do is it will honk the car horn. And you can hear the honk and, you know, make your way over to the vehicle. Now, let's just say there's two Waymos that are pulled up next to each other. How do you know which one to get into? Well, the car is not going to unlock for the wrong passenger. So if it's not your car, it's not going to let you into the car.
Does it know you're the wrong passenger? How does it know you're the wrong passenger?
It uses technology to know that you're the wrong passenger. It has something to do with the smartphone that you're using and the app that you're using. It can tell if the passenger who's using the Waymo app is getting into the vehicle.
So sort of building on that conversation, you talked about how we as blind people need to be at the table as this stuff's being designed. Mm-hmm. Makes perfect sense to me. So what are the challenges? You talked about one of them. What are the other challenges that blind people face that are sort of unique to our population?
So one major challenge that I see is a challenge we face with rideshare too. I mean, there's multiple challenges, but a major challenge, the next challenge you're going to think about is your destination, right?
Right.
So if I'm traveling, let's just say they had Waymos in Baltimore and I'm traveling from my apartment building to the Inner Harbor. You know, what if there wasn't parking that the car could get to drop me off? So it maybe it wants to pull two blocks away. All of a sudden, as a blind person, I might be disoriented and not actually know how to get from where I'm being dropped off to the Inner Harbor. So one thing we're pushing for is that we want to make sure that, you know, people have the option to choose, because, you know, there are people that are going to want to be dropped off at a curb cut at the curb, even if it's a block or two away from their destination. But there are people that want to be dropped off in front of the destination they're going to. So we need to make sure that that happens. We want to make sure that, you know, these cars are smart enough where if we want to be dropped off in front of a destination, even if it isn't, you know, 8 inches from a curb, that we can still be dropped off. Or if we're a blind person who uses a wheelchair, we want to make sure we can be dropped off at a curb cut where we can get out of the vehicle.
I need to backtrack a second. My question wasn't 100% answered before. How does the car know where you want to get dropped off?
Sure. So you put in your pickup location, just like you would with a regular rideshare, and then you would put in your drop off location, just like you would with rideshare. So you would search on your app for your drop off location and put in that drop off location.
So one of the things that strikes me sort of listening to this, this all sounds really cool and it's coming, right? I mean, it's not stoppable, I don't think, at this point, unless something unforeseen happens. What this means is there's going to be even a greater divide between those of us who know how to use this technology and those of us who don't, and those of us who have resources, you know, money, and those of us who don't. How do you sort of bridge those gaps?
Yeah, I think that's where advocacy comes into play. So we need to be having conversations with these companies about the fact that, and we have talked to the companies about the fact that a lot of people who are blind, you know, the unemployment rate amongst blind people we know is very high. The underemployment rate is very high, and a lot of blind people are living on limited resources. So we do talk about that. And you know, we also do talk about the technology divide, right? So I think we need to be more vocal about coming up with a system where a person can place a phone call to be able to order a car. What is that going to look like? I'm not sure. But I mean, I know that, you know, there was a similar app for Uber called GoGo Grandparent, where you could schedule a ride.
I was just going to say that GoGo Grandparents designed for people with no apps.
Right. Right.
The problem with that app, as convenient and as great as it is it costs more.
Right.
You know, that's the trade-off. You know, you use old technology, you pay more.
Right.
And maybe that's the way it should be, but it is sort of dissonant with the fact that some of us, you know, a lot of us, as you say, are unemployed or underemployed and don't make
exactly
the buku bucks. And I don't know how we live in a capitalist country, right?
Right.
How do you square those dissonances?
Well, there are some manufacturers. I don't know if you've ever heard of May Mobility. It's a company that operates autonomous vehicles for paratransit systems, and they use a test driver. So you could be in one of these cars and you wouldn't even know it's an autonomous vehicle because it has a driver behind the wheel. So their whole idea is, how do we transport people who may not need to use a great big paratransit van? You know, maybe you don't need that. Maybe you're good in a car. So I think the next stage would be that we would want to push for this to be incorporated into our transportation systems as a paratransit model. I mean, I think that's where we would want to go with it.
So let's talk just in general terms about how safe these cars are. You know, every once in a while you see a story in the somewhere about, you know, an accident on one of these cars. And then the response is, yeah, but drivers create more accidents, which is probably true. How are we with regards to safety? And then sort of along with that, what's the timeline that you estimate? When might this stuff really, you know, like right now it's in San Francisco basically, but where are we when it might
right
across the country?
Well, I'm not a safety expert. So, you know, I would, maybe there should be a secondary conversation, you know, with either an industry, you know, sure, Waymo or Cruise, or perhaps the Autonomous Vehicle Industry Association would be able to answer that a little bit better than I can.
That's fair.
But I can tell you that they have traveled millions and millions of miles, and it's proving to be, you know, a very safe technology. You know, even the recent incident that we hear about that happened in San Francisco, where a person was struck by a vehicle and they were thrown in front of a Cruise autonomous vehicle. So they weren't struck by the vehicle. They were thrown in front of a moving car. And, you know, it took that car 20 feet to stop. So there was a person that was pulled for 20 feet. And what happened was San Francisco responded to that immediately. They pulled that company's license to operate in San Francisco. So I think that, you know, we definitely have regulatory agencies that are monitoring these issues. The industry understands the need to provide data about accidents and about, you know, issues that happen, and to be very transparent. In terms of where it's developing, I would say that right now they're expanding into Los Angeles. They're expanding into the San Francisco Peninsula. They are in Phoenix commercially, but they're also moving into, you know, Houston and Austin. They've done, it's not commercial, but they've even done autonomous vehicle testing in DC, and we're encouraging them to come into Maryland. You know, there are 25 states in the U.S. Kentucky was the most recent that have passed regulations that allow for autonomous vehicles. And a lot of it is happening in the trucking space, but these rideshare companies, these autonomous vehicle level 4 rideshare companies are moving into various communities. So I think what it's going to take in order for it to go nationally is we will need what's called a framework, a federal framework for autonomous vehicles. And, you know, there's Congress has tried to pass a couple of these. One that actually passed through the House but failed in the Senate. It was called the Self-Drive Act. And there's a couple of key items that we want to make sure are in these frameworks in order to make sure that they remain accessible to blind people. But I would say I'm hearing that, you know, within the next 7 to 10 years, they're going to be on the roads and very, very prominent. They will be rideshare though. You can't buy an autonomous vehicle.
Right.
But we're not seeing that coming on the horizon anytime soon.
So I'm clear, Jesse, autonomous vehicles, though they would assist blind people, they're not just for blind people, right? Anybody can use them.
Anybody can use an autonomous vehicle. Absolutely. Anybody can use an autonomous vehicle. I'm only speaking about it from the blind perspective because, you know, that's my area of interest.
So it's just another question that you might not know the answer to, but I live in a rural county in Oregon right now, and we don't, to the best of my knowledge, we don't have Uber or Lyft right now.
Mm-hmm.
It may be coming, but it ain't here yet. And I guess my question is, you know, it's one of those interesting things. I mean, the truth of the matter is that in cities, we blind folk have other options when it comes to mass transportation. You know, some of us can use them and some of us can and, you know, all that. But here in a place like Coos Bay, Oregon, there is limited of that stuff. I mean, this stuff would be really useful here, but I don't know if it's cost effective. You know, this is one of those puzzles.
Yes.
Have you heard anything about it going to rural communities?
I've heard Congress, members of Congress calling for the need for it to go to rural communities. And I think it's going to be more challenging, like for the exact reasons you were saying, for it to go into rural communities. But if we're thinking about rideshare, a major component of rideshare in a rural community that is going to keep the price higher and make it more difficult to have rideshare in a rural community, would be the driver piece of it. You know, you have to pay the driver to operate a vehicle. And if the driver's not able to take enough rides, you know, there's not going to be rideshare. So I think this type of technology definitely has more, I could see it being more adopted in some ways, you know, because it still gives everybody who uses it that sense of independence, you know, whether you're a senior who's not able to drive anymore for any particular reason, or you're a blind person, or maybe you have seizures and you're not allowed to have a driver's license. I mean, this type of technology could impact all of us.
Bob, how are we doing for time?
I think we can bring in our participants now. I'm Bob Branco. He's Peter Altschul, and you're listening to In Perspective. Today we have with us Jesse Shirek of the National Federation of the Blind. He's talking about autonomous vehicles, which is a subject that could be for debate. We've got people who are very much in favor of them and people who are very much opposed. So let's bring in our participants and see how they feel about autonomous vehicles. Trish, do we have any hands raised?
Yes, we actually have 4 hands raised. And the first one is Renee. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, yes. Renee.
Thank you for the program. But I want to tell you, you are very much misinformed about autonomous cars. And I say that respectively. First of all, Tesla is definitely an autonomous car. The 12.5 beta has just been released. 12.6 full self-driving will be released later on this year. There should be autonomous vehicles or cars like Waymo. Well, see, Waymo is geofenced. It can only go in a certain place. When Tesla releases their autonomous vehicles for ride sharing, it's going to go wherever you need it to go outside of a specific area. And that should be released, I'm thinking, by the next national convention in July. I would be very surprised if it wasn't. But that's, I just wanted to bring that out. Waymo is geofenced. I wish we had it in our small town here in Mount Carmel. At least we would have some ride sharing. I look at it as freedom to, because with ride share the way it is now, you have to plan for advance if you can go, when you can go. It's always a big if. And with what's coming is going to be freedom for the blind to go when they want to go, where they want to go, better than Uber. And I'm truly, you know, amazed what's coming, not to mention the robotics. And I'm following Tesla very closely, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much for at least listening to what I had to say. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your contribution, Renee. Trish?
All right. Next we have Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Hello. Well, Jesse, if you had a response to what the lady just said, sneak it in there. I just wanted to first let you know I'm the unofficial statistician for Bob, and you are breaking the records for the number of people on the call, and I give you all the credit for that. So I just want to let you know that.
Thank you for that, Tony.
You can respond to Renee that. If you'd like first. Jesse.
Can I? Okay.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I would, you know, I think what I would suggest is that we bring on somebody from the Autonomous Vehicles Industry Association, because they are an industry of fully autonomous vehicles. Currently, you know, as cool as Tesla is, it's not fully autonomous. There are no Teslas on the road that will operate without a person sitting behind the wheel. The technology built into Teslas is much different than fully autonomous technology. You know, it may be level three, it may be level two autonomous technology, but when you talk about geofenced, like a Waymo is a level four autonomous vehicle technology. What you're suggesting is that these Teslas will be a level five autonomous technology going coast to coast. And in order for that to happen, the federal government is going to have to pass a framework for that to be able to happen. Currently, fully autonomous vehicles have to be permitted in their local jurisdictions.
Okay.
So that's what I would say about that.
All right. Tony, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, now actually I do have a question. This one's not easy, Jesse. I worry about the pressure for the blind to be not excluded, overriding maybe some really fundamental ethical issues, which we're hearing, you know, indirectly and directly in every conversation, having to do with is there a line below which these vehicles cannot, you know, must, you know, if they were to fall below a certain line, let's say safety or accuracy or reliability, where the blind will say, the heck with this, being included is not worth it. I'm worried about the pressure to be included overriding maybe a lower level ethical line. And I know this is not an easy question, but I think we kind of do worry about it a little bit.
And I think it's fair to be concerned about personal safety in a vehicle. I mean, I think that our organization, the National Federation of the Blind, is very interested in ensuring that this technology remains accessible to blind people, and new technologies that emerge in the space are accessible to blind people. I mean, I think the technology, it's being designed for everybody, like Bob brought to our attention. We're looking at how can we ensure that it's accessible to the blind community? I think as it stands right now, you know, the technology appears to be very, very safe. And I think, you know, if accidents emerge and if issues emerge, you know, we will all have to make personal decisions about whether or not we feel comfortable making use of the technology.
Just in case you were worried about me, I got kicked off the internet for a while and I'm back.
Okay. Tony, did you have anything to add at this time?
Yeah, I suppose the only, this is the comment, the difference between us who cannot see and everybody else is that we cannot see. So, you know, when the vehicle is about to fail, we're going to probably not have too much warning. So in addition to everything else, to make this as human as possible, I suppose there ought to be something that gives us a little bit of the kind of warning that somebody who can see might have if there's going to be a failure or an accident. And I'm not sure what that is, but maybe an alarm bell, like a proximity indicator goes off or something. I frankly would really rather brace myself before I die than just be sitting there dying. So,
Tony, none of us want to die. None of us want to die.
But that's our bottom line here, living or dying.
So Jesse, if you don't mind, let me respond to Tony briefly. Mm-hmm. So you and I agree that there should be a warning. So what do we do when we hear the warning? How do we know how to act on it?
I think we have the dignity of knowing that something is about to happen to us as opposed to not knowing that anything is going to happen to us. That's really the bottom line on that. It's not a Jesse issue, but if he happens to be talking to somebody, maybe he'll remember it.
Yeah, I'll certainly write that down. I would like to respond if that would be okay.
Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah.
So one thing that I do want to say is that, this technology is new. It's emerging technology and there are flaws with it, as we know. So interestingly enough, the President Riccobono did some testimony in front of the Energy and Commerce Committee on the ADA anniversary last year, the 33rd ADA anniversary. And he talked about an experience that he had in San Francisco where the autonomous vehicle pulled up to a red light and didn't restart. And he was concerned about what would happen just for the same reasons as you're stating, how do we know if there's an issue? Well, what happened immediately, think about like how OnStar works or these communication systems that some cars have. What happened was, there was a tone and a person came over the speakers of the car, and said, sir, your car has stalled and we are resolving the issue. But I agree with you. I'd be curious to know if there is an alarm system that, detects an impending crash if the vehicle can't avoid it. I think that's some really great feedback.
Well, Jesse, if I may, up until now and even today, if a car is stalled at a red light and chooses not to go when the light is green, the police will be all over that driver because he's holding up traffic. That can't happen with an autonomous vehicle. So what does the law say about that?
They are working that through. They are working that through in terms of being able to communicate with the police force, emergency forces. These autonomous vehicle companies are working together with police departments and emergency rescue departments. So that is something that is going to need to be resolved. And, what is the answer? I don't quite know what the answer is because I haven't been put in that position. But like I said, I think it would be great to get somebody who's actually in the industry, who's part of these types of conversations to speak on that.
And we have four hands raised, just so you know.
Thank you, Tony, as always. Great contribution. Okay, go right ahead, Trish.
All right, next we have Herbie.
All right, Herbie, go right ahead.
All right, so I've got a comment, and it's really more directed at you, Bob, and anybody that is feeling uncertain about, that they want to get into a self-driving car. And I'm just going to kind of briefly give you my perspective based on my experiences here, because this is in perspective. So I am completely blind and I do not have access to sighted people to drive me around since I chose to live independently a long time ago. So over the years, I rely heavily on public transportation, of course. This has meant buses, cabs, and a lot of walking back when I did more of that and when I lived in a different area of the States. And I have experienced over the years several run-ins with cars, both from the outside. I've actually been hit by a car, and I've also been in a couple of minor car accidents. All these cars have been driven by humans, no computers or anything like that. So people talk about the safety of self-driving cars, and I can't help but wonder, well, why not at least find out if it really is safe or not? Because humans have proven to be unsafe over the years. You know, there's plenty of safe drivers out there, for the record. So, you know, why not find out if self-driving cars are going to, you know, they might, well, they've made the same mistakes that the human drivers in the situations I was in would have. And so I think that, and not only that, but as here in Houston, I've also had to deal with the frustration of, you know, we were talking about the issue of how does the car know where to drop you off or anything like that. Well, here in Houston, and I've had to deal a lot of times, it's not been so bad with Uber because of how their GPS works. But in the past, I've had to deal with a lot of drivers that English is not their first language. So why would I might have better results if I'm arguing with a computer at least as to where I want to be dropped off as opposed to a human. So for me, I feel like, you know, maybe it does need to prove itself. I acknowledge that, but I think it has the potential to at least make a good case for why it should at least try to, you know, prove itself. And GPS has gotten a lot more accurate over the years. Like, I've been really impressed with, like, with Uber, for instance. Overall, it seems to be pretty precise in just where you get dropped off, you know, and this is just with the human drivers relying on it. So I think self-driving cars can really make a case for themselves and why they should be considered an option.
And maybe they won't. Over time, maybe they won't, you know, but I tend to agree with you, you know, the more options, the better. We just have to hope that this option is a good one.
Yeah. And freedom, you know, like somebody said earlier, you know, ideally I'd love to have my own car, and it's good to know that if I have if I ever get my own car one day, it won't count against me as SSI with SSI as things currently stand. But, you know, that's probably never going to happen in my lifetime, at least. But, well, you know,
thank you, Merv. I think your comment is important.
Point well taken. Jesse, do you want to respond to Herbie before we move on to another participant?
I do have a comment that would be kind of maybe adding on to what Herbie said. I also would like to think about another advantage that might be in place in terms of autonomous vehicles. My wife Sherry is a guide dog user. She's had 5 guide dogs. She's been using them probably for longer than she's been, you know, she was sighted till she was 23, and she's probably been using dogs longer than that. So, you know, we deal with rideshare discrimination on an ongoing basis where the drivers refuse to pick up a person with a guide dog. When you remove a biased driver from the car, you remove the opportunity for discrimination by a human. So whether you're a person of color, whether you're, you know, a service dog user, whether there's other reasons you think you might be discriminated against, this affords, you know, as Peter said, more transportation opportunities. And that's really what we're pushing for.
All right. Trish, who do we have next?
We have Jean Parker.
Hello. Jean. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, Jean. Go right ahead.
So I have some comments here. And the first one is that I cannot wait until humans are not behind the wheel. I think it's just been a catastrophe in society to have humans driving lethal weapons on the streets. And it is true that when there are problems, they are certainly amplified for us. My suggestion about that would be that there should be in the planning mechanisms for this, there should be ongoing scenario planning and what we call an emergency preparedness tabletop exercises to introduce the extreme into the equation. You know, what's likely to happen and who will have the consequences for that, and what is the technical fix for that? The fact is that you can, and I have, had an accident on a very fast moving interstate with no indication that it was coming and no information from the driver that it was coming. And so that, again, the human factor. And I think that so with the invention of the car, there was certainly a cultural shift that took place in society. There was a lot of death. and a lot of destruction and a lot of you could say deterioration in society with the invention of the car. And so the same kind of cultural shift is happening here, where this is a new thing that people have to get used to. And how do they relate to it, or do they relate to it? The accidents that are caused will always be disproportionately reported in the media, whereas accidents that are caused by humans are just commonplace. You know, those happen every day and, oh, well, whatever. I do think that the app can play a role in notifications of problems if there was an interface that was instituted in the ecosystem of the vehicle, that there could be some status reporting in the app for various things, like you're going to get in an accident, or you know, you're in such and such a location, or you're some distance away from where you want it to be dropped off. I don't know. It seems like something in the app could be engineered to do that. And finally, I am thinking that for the people living in rural areas, this actually might be much more doable, because as somebody said earlier, you don't have to pay a driver,
right,
to waste their time going and coming in both directions and then taking the chance of not being able to get back, you know? So that's the challenge in rural areas. Maybe you can get one direction, but can you get both directions is always the question. So I have the Waymo app in waiting on my phone for the next time I go up to Phoenix, which will be probably later this month, to try to use it now that Waymo's been expanded into, I guess, the metro area. And what I am interested in knowing is how does the fare for a typical Waymo ride compare with, say, an Uber or a Lyft?
Jesse?
I don't have an answer to that question. I've not had the opportunity to get into a Waymo yet. So I don't have an answer to that. I'm hoping to be able to take a Waymo in the near future, and I'll certainly ask that question.
Thank you, Gene.
Thanks, Gene.
I appreciate
always.
It. Real good comments.
I think we have time for at least one more. So, Tricia, who's next?
Joe Marks.
Joe, from Philly.
From Philly.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I enjoyed this conversation a lot because I'm very interested in the artificial intelligence advancement, especially with driving. Because even I lost my sight 3 years ago, but even when I had low vision, I always was around friends that drove and wish I could. My question to you, it has to do a lot with what was brought up by Peter earlier, which is the idea of price gouging and price wars. When Waymo or other companies, because as we know, it will expand, how can we, just like you discussed about Social Security, how can we combat and fight like capping like the budget for how much they can charge? Because some of these companies, when you take out the human element, they don't have to pay a computer. So they may have to pay for the technology, but they may not have to pay for the driver anymore. So that means that they're making more margin per ride. So how can we reassure the riders and the public that we're not going to get price gouged by companies that see that as an opportunity?
That's a good question. I think to start with, I think about our society and, you know, we're a capitalistic society. So if this technology is much more expensive to use than rideshare with a human driver, I don't see people using it. So they're going to have to remain competitive with rideshare. And I think as we see it expand, you know, the more cars that we get onto the streets, the more widely available this technology is. You know, as there's more supply, you know, the demand would be reduced and, you know, let's, you know, hope with economics that the price goes down. But I think, you know, bringing this to the attention of manufacturers is important. I think the bottom line is if it's too expensive, people aren't going to use it.
Yeah.
I think that's the bottom line.
I don't know if we have time to, I think I'm going to drop my comment in honor of time.
We have about one or two more minutes, so maybe briefly we can squeeze one more in. Thank you, Joe.
Trish. All right, and we do have one more hand. Pam Coffey.
Yes, my question, and it's based on something that happened to me one time, is what's going to happen when, and this is a spinoff of Tony's question, what's going to happen? You're in an autonomous vehicle and the vehicle just happens to run over a nail or a piece of glass or some other such thing that was conveniently left out in the road and has a flat tire. Is that car going to know to pull off the road into a safe parking area, or is it just going to stop right there in the road? And I don't know how to change a tire. What's going to happen with situations like that?
Sure. Good question.
We have about 30 seconds, Jesse.
Gotcha.
Okay. Situations like this are already occurring, and these cars are trained to pull over to the side of the road to get out of the way of traffic.
And my last comment is this is why scenario planning for the worst case scenarios need to happen. You know, I'm sure some of us, they're very smart people happening, but you know, what happens if the technology doesn't work? If there's a malware attack or something, you know, all that stuff needs to be, I'm sure it's being thought about by much smarter people than I am.
We're out of time. Jesse, thank you very much for coming back and enlightening us on what's happening with the autonomous vehicle. We'll see what happens in the future and hopefully everything will work out for everybody involved. Thanks, everybody. I'm Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings. We'll be back next week on In Perspective. Take care, everybody.